you, Professor Orme, for talking to the History Reclaimed podcast series today. You are, or your book has been nominated for our book prize shortlist of 2022. Why did you write this book now, and why did you think it was relevant? There's probably been quite a lot of books on the church.
I wanted to bring together three different things: church buildings, people, and worship. Because, as you say, a lot is written about churches, particularly church architecture, but it doesn't take account of how a church was used. Why was it built in that shape with those particular furnishings? Architecture doesn't tell you that. It gives you glimpses and leads, but you need to go to other sources for that. Now, worship is a subject that is very little studied, especially medieval worship. It's partly because of the difficulty of the sources, which are in Latin. It's also down to the fact that very few people nowadays are much into a Christian religion, and they don't really understand or empathize with medieval worship. And then finally, of course, you can't have church buildings or church worship without people. It would be a great mistake to suppose that everybody in the past was devout, and that the Middle Ages was solely an age of faith, because our ancestors were like ourselves, and they included people who were devout and people who were not very devout and people who were not devout at all. I wanted to bring together these three different areas because they tend to be kept apart.
And in doing so, you've covered the history up until, from the early church up until the 1500s, the beginning of the 16th century. And I believe that there were a lot of churches in England by the 1200s. I believe about 9,500 churches. Is that right?
It's somewhere around that number. It's difficult to get an exact number because it depends on legal status and so on. And then, as well as the parish churches, which is what I was mainly concerned with, you've probably got about 25 or 30,000 chapels as well. And some of those are very similar to parish churches, but they just don't have the status.
And then, as well as looking at the churches, and you spoke about the architecture, it's the people that makes your book so engaging. The stories of men taking hawks and animals to churches, women wearing their best clothes, parishioners falling asleep or not attending, needing to speak Latin as well. These patterns of church going, they're very much still resilient today, aren't they?
Yes, there's a great difference between the past and the present, because from about the 13th century onwards, you were expected to go to church, and there were indeed disciplinary processes by which you could get into trouble if you didn't go regularly to church, although we don't really know in detail how often those were applied. It simply wasn't possible in practice to get everybody to go to church any more than it's possible today to get everyone to drive at the requisite speeds on the roads, for example. As I say, you've got devout people and you've got people who try not to go to church any more than they have to. The difficulty for parish clergy was that you can't really run your parish as an autocracy. You've got to go along with people to some extent, because otherwise you'll make yourself very unpopular.
And the clergy as well, your records show that they, in some cases, need to be, should I say, hauled up or disciplined, because they might not have been delivering the services in the way that was intended, or indeed acting in a very appropriate manner.
That's right, yes. I mean, churches traditionally have not always been very effective in ensuring what clergy do at a local level. And of course, this has come up in recent years a lot, hasn't it, in terms of sexual abuse and so on. We don't tend to hear about that in the Middle Ages, but we do hear about failure to do the services properly or regularly or at the same times. And, of course, clergy were open to the same temptations as lay people were in terms of sexuality, for example. So from about 1200, clergy were not allowed to be married. But, of course, they sometimes had partners or people with whom they had occasional sex, and that was another problem for the church to sort out.
And in terms of the parishioners, there were the normal services that needed to be attended, whether that's on a Sunday or at Christmas, Lent, Easter, summer. There would be births, coming of age, marriages, and of course, sickness and death too. But is there a different way in which these landmark services were attended in previous centuries to now?
Well, we don't have exact figures for church attendance until you get to the middle of the 19th century and the famous religious census of 1841, which is the only one that's actually ever been carried out because people complained afterwards that it wasn't accurate and wasn't fair. You know, one doesn't know very much in detail about the church attendance, but for various reasons, the expectation that you should go, and social relationships, the fact that there wasn't much else to do on a Sunday in a village in particular, and it was a good way of meeting people and so on. So you're going to get quite a lot of people locally in church on a Sunday morning. There were three services that you were supposed to go to, matins at about 8 o'clock, Mass at about 9 o'clock, Evensong at about 3 o'clock. I think it's doubtful whether most people went to all three, but they do seem to have often gone to matins and then Mass afterwards. And then, of course, they went to church for baptisms, the churching of mothers after they'd given birth, marriages, although marriages did not have to be done in church. They were recommended to be done in church, but you could marry away from the church. And then, as you say, funerals as well. And I think these would have brought out larger groups of people as they do today. Relations and friends would have wanted to go to baptisms and funerals and marriages. And, of course, you had social events afterwards, which was another way of encouraging people to come. But we can't put down the exact numbers.
And I'm reminded of the Vicar of Dibley episode where Dawn French lets people bring their animals to church. But that is one story you tell in your book, isn't it? The man who wanted to take his hawks and animals to church.
Yes, there was no such thing as a pets service in medieval or Tudor England. Some people did take dogs, and dogs got in because I think if you left your dog outside, the next person who came in, you know, the dog probably came in as well, and they were a bit of a nuisance. And eventually, you do get in the 16th century the officer known as the dog whipper, whose job is to get them out, and not in a particularly friendly way either. And then people do seem to have used, or some people seem to have used, church as a way of showing off, so that you wear your very best clothes. In the case of some men, they take their hawk in with them, because hawks are all about social status. Only certain people are allowed to have them, certain ranks are allowed to have them. So you're showing off that you're of the wealthier classes if you take your hawk in with you.
And I think perhaps some of us still put on our best Sunday coat to go to church, or at least I know that my grandmother used to as well, a Methodist. But in bringing the architecture, the people, the services and the clergy together in your book, Going to Church in Medieval England, I assume that, unlike some historians, you were swimming in books and records, that you perhaps had too much to contend with, rather than saying, well, where am I going to find out about this? The records are all there, aren't they?
Well, it took a lifetime to collect them. I started in 1962, when I was 21. You can work out it's taken me nearly 60 years to get that book together. And it's like reconstructing a mosaic of a Roman villa or something like that, you know, with the bits all over the place. You're hunting around for the bits. And this is what's deterred people in the past, I think, because if you look at any one source, you won't find out very much. And actually, the book improved during the first COVID lockdown, because I wasn't able to get into my local library, which is the Bodleian Library in Oxford, for several months. So I was stuck at home with nothing to do except trawl the internet for such books as were available online. And I ended up, because, say, I had a free morning and nothing much to do, with reading through very unlikely sources. And perhaps by the end of the morning, I only had one snippet that I'd gathered. It wouldn't have really been worth, in normal circumstances, looking for that. The time waste would have been too great. But with nothing else to do, gradually the snippets mounted up. And I was able to add a lot more detail to my book as a result of that than I would have done otherwise. So that was a nice personal outcome from COVID.
And a nice story there. But how many churches did you visit in person? Did your curiosity mean that you had to go and think, well, perhaps I can only get this record in the church itself? It hasn't been digitised.
No, I mean, all church records are now in archives or in print. It would, in principle, yes, it would have been good to visit every medieval church in England, because you would come across various interesting features to do with seating, for example, screens, of which there were many in medieval churches. You don't get images now, on the whole, because they've been removed at the Reformation. You will get some wall paintings, which have been revealed in modern times. And the way in which churches are laid out, the transepts and aisles and that sort of thing, that can tell you things. But I'm afraid in human life there's only a certain amount of time available. It really wasn't possible to go everywhere. I suppose I've visited in the course of my life a couple of thousand churches, and I've remembered details from some of them. But it would be quite possible for somebody now to go round and add further details from what remains of the architecture of medieval churches.
Well, if they've got a spare 60 years, like you seem to have had. But any mention of bell ringers? I'm a bell ringer.
Yes. Actually, I found out a bit more about that at the very end of my research, and the book was pretty well in the hands of the publishers by then. And so I would have said a little bit more about bell ringing. It's clear that it came into England in Anglo-Saxon times, and it's popular during the Middle Ages. First of all, it's the big early churches, monasteries, that get bells. But by the 12th, certainly 13th centuries, parish churches have got two or three bells, and they gradually increase the number, so that by the time you get to the 16th century, it's more usual to have five or six. But they don't ring them in the modern manner of change ringing. They ring them all together, so you get this confusion of sounds, mixture of sounds when they're being rung, and there are rules about how you ring them. That you start before services, you start with one bell and then you go on to another bell or two bells, and finally a higher or lower register bell or three bells, and then you ring more on festival days than you do on ordinary days and that sort of thing. So the bells are very important. The question is who rang them? That's a very good one. The parish clerk rings the bell for weekday services. It would just be one bell, and he rings it during Mass as well at the point of the elevation when the bread and wine is held up in church. Quite who you get for other occasions when you need several people ringing bells, I don't know. But the bells survived the Reformation, and then in the late 16th, early 17th centuries, people think, oh, we'd like to do something else with them, so they invent change ringing.
Well, it's good to know that when I do my change ringing inappropriately, if I'm creating a racket, well, that's how it should be, so I can make an excuse in the future. But finally, Professor Orme, if we're looking at the Church of England and the 60 years it took you to bring all this copious research together from the archives, you presumably haven't had the same publisher for those 60 years. Did the publisher ever say, hurry up?
Not on this occasion, no. I mean, I didn't have a contract when I was 21 to write a book, obviously, or not that book. I've written books on different subjects during the course of my life. I went to the publishers, well, it's 22 now, about 3 years ago. What with COVID and other things, there was a bit of a delay on publishing it, about 2 years, but they had the book. I was waiting for them rather than them waiting for me.
And just a quick fire question, did you ever think of giving up, of just saying, well, you know, as you said, you've got other projects, other books to work on. Did you think this is just taking too long?
Well, no, as I say, because I didn't intend at the age of 21 to write a book 60 years later. This is very much a result of my researches over the whole course of my working life. I started out writing about the history of education. If you're studying schools in the Middle Ages, you're constantly dealing with ecclesiastical records. So I learned a lot about medieval church, writing about medieval education. Then I've also written about the history of childhood, and one got a lot more insight into religion by doing that, because you had to cover baptism and confirmation and even funerals and things like that. So it was really towards the end of my working life that I decided, yes, I know a lot of bits and pieces about the medieval church, and it's about time now to bring them all together and fill in the gaps. I thought I knew a lot about worship. I'd read a lot of the medieval service books over the course of my life. What I hadn't realized was that you can't reconstruct medieval worship from medieval prayer books, which is not something that people had realized previously. The reason is that you can never trust clergy actually to do what the book tells them to do.
And have our services remain very much the same? People talk about the Book of Common Prayer.
Well, the Book of Common Prayer is the coming of the Reformation in 1549 and a great change to worship in church. The three services of the later Middle Ages are brought down to being two. The Mass disappears. The services are translated into English, but they're very much simplified. They have no ceremony to speak of after 1549. One of the things I wanted to deal with in my book was this transition from medieval Catholicism to early Protestantism. But on the whole, that's regarded as a great divide, and people like Eamon Duffy, who've written very well about the late medieval church, see it as coming to an end, a tragic end, when the Reformation comes. And I don't share that view. I believe that the reformers actually were careful to keep a lot of what people were used to, and the people themselves, anyway, insisted on a lot of things continuing that they were used to. And when you think about worship in church, it's not just about the words that are spoken or listened to. It's also about where you sit, it's who you meet, it's how it fits into your day. And those things were not affected by the Reformation. You have to realise that seating in churches, which they all had by the 16th century, was allocated according to social rank. So you've got the most important people in the best seats in the chancel and the front of the nave, and the further back in the church you go, the lower down the social status. So going to church was very much a part of exhibiting your social status. And the reformers were very careful not to interfere with that at all. There would have been a lot more opposition if they tried to do that. So that a lot of church going remains the same before and after the Reformation.
That's so interesting. And just finally, Professor Orme, the reaction to your book, it's had a very good reception, hasn't it?
Well, it's very kind of you to say so. I'm a little bit surprised, because it doesn't strike me as an easy read. And oddly enough, about 4 or 5 years ago, I wrote a history of England's cathedrals, which I think is a book of much more obvious popular interest, because we all know about cathedrals and we visit them from time to time. Nobody had ever written a history of cathedrals. I mean, there are lots of books about cathedrals, but they're nearly all books of photographs telling you what you can see. And what I tried to do in my book, The History of England's Cathedrals, was take the whole lot of them from 597 down to the present day and show how they'd developed and how they were caught up in the national story of the Norman conquest, the Reformation, the Civil Wars, the Victorian reforms, the rise of democracy, and that sort of thing. And I thought that was much more of an interesting book for the general reader. But for one reason or another, which I won't bother to bore you with, that did not have the same sort of impact, whereas, for reasons that I'm not entirely clear about, this book has got a more positive reaction from readers.
Well, I just wanted to thank you for giving your time so generously to the History Reclaim podcast series today, and congratulate you for being shortlisted for the History Reclaimed Book Prize 2022. I very much enjoyed talking to you. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed.